is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. A lot of suburbanites have a garden tucked in their backyard with a row of leaf lettuce, a few pepper plants, some beans, and four or five tomato plants. But some people look at their yards and reimagine them as suburban micro-farms with carefully planned edible landscapes filled with a variety of herbs, fruits, and vegetables. And in the process, these micro-farmers are reimagining themselves as 21st century homesteaders. To explore the modern-day suburban homesteading movement, we are joined by the owner of the 10th Acre Farm and author of The Suburban Micro-Farm, Modern Solutions for Busy People, Amy Strauss, and the director of Turner Farm and Community Garden Program, Peter Huttinger, and horticulture extension agent for Campbell County, Sarah Stoltz. To join our discussion, please call 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Welcome, everybody.
Good to be here.
Good to Cincinnati Edition. And Amy, let's start out. I mean, we're sort of going to focus today on the movement that you're really part of. So what is it that set you on this path? I mean, did you grow up on a farm and decide you were now living in a suburban situation and you were going to recreate your childhood? Or what was going on here?
It was really a complete accident, actually. I was a high school teacher. And
that'll ruin almost anybody, but go ahead.
At some point along the way, I realized that teaching is actually a very respectable career path, but I discovered that I wasn't totally enjoying it and I wasn't totally passionate about it. And I think as a teacher, you have to really be passionate about what you do. It's very important when you're working with our children. And so I kind of fell into gardening on accident. It was kind of something I wanted to do in the interim while I figured out what I wanted to do next with my life. And through a series of events, I found myself growing food as sort of my second career and writing about it.
So how long between leaving teaching and writing your first book, which came out in 2016, how long a period was that to sort of work out what it is that you're thinking about with this micro farming?
That was about a 10-year journey for me, actually. Okay. And, you know, at first it was me gardening as therapy. I called it my therapy, my dirt therapy. I kind of felt lost. I didn't know what I wanted to do next with my life. I went down to the Civic Garden Center of Greater Cincinnati, took some gardening classes, and I found a job posting on the bulletin board for a landscape gardening position. That was a really excellent experience for me. My boss, Sharon Rosberg of Cool Blue Garden, she's now retired, but that was an amazing experience for me. She knew all the Latin names of plants, which I thought was incredible because I was new to the experience. And I started taking plants home to tinker with in my yard. And that kind of set me off on this journey.
Okay. Sarah and Peter, Sarah, starting with you, do you know other people? I mean, I know there's a movement. I can tell that from getting on the web and sort of exploring this. But do you personally know other people who are following the path that Amy is, that are part of your experience in Northern Kentucky, in your case, Sarah?
Yeah, absolutely. We're starting to get new farmers that have acquired some land or thinking about purchasing land. A few coworkers and I, we did a Farm Start Homestead program last year, and come to find out there are a lot of new, younger farmers, especially in Campbell County and the surrounding counties, and I'm assuming in Cincinnati as well. And you don't have to have much land. And so even in the urban sectors of where I work, more folks are transitioning into even one little container of gardening. But as I was describing to Amy, just one little pot in front of your yard, you know, where I felt like years ago it was you put it in your backyard, you know, so showcasing in front of your yard, on the side of your yard, transitioning maybe some of your turf grass into, you know, more edibles, or transitioning some of your shade landscape beds into more cool season crops. So, yes, I definitely see that. Maybe not so much as the terminology of permaculture. And I was discussing with Amy about that, too. You know, I'm really excited about getting folks eager and excited to get out and do some horticulture therapy out in their front landscape or side or wherever they may be, or in a community garden. But I definitely see that. And then some folks are just doing it for themselves and their family, or they're doing it as a offset of some income. So I hope to goodness it's not going away. These little seeds can bring in a lot of money for our family and good healthy food as well.
Peter, how about you in your experience?
Well, in Cincinnati, too, there's a lot going on. I mean, there are families and individuals growing food for their own consumption. But there's a small there's a number of people doing smaller size market gardens and small farms, and that could be anywhere from a half acre to 5 acres. And people are finding when they're garden intensively that they can make a good supplemental income, or in some cases support themselves. So I think that it's really an exciting time.
Well, Amy, your term, you have a 10th acre. You have a 10th acre farm. We're not talking about multiples here. On a 10th acre, and we're going to get into this, how much produce are you actually getting out of that 10th acre, and in terms of what it can provide for you or neighbors or whatever?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good question. I think, you know, it always depends on what your space provides. So in my case, my little 10th of an acre in the suburbs, we had a number of challenges. And that's actually one reason why I was inspired to write about my experience and share with that on my website and in my book, because a lot of us have challenges. We don't have flat land. We don't have, we don't have full sun. We have soil challenges. And when we come across, you know, these challenges, it can make us not want to do it, or it can become a barrier. And I wanted to, sort of like a curious scientist, I wanted to figure out what was the key to unlock these challenges, because I had many of them on my property. Just one example is the backyard, of course, was sloping. It was shady. And the previous owners had an in-ground pool, which they filled in. And so whenever I went to dig in the ground, I came across blue-painted chunks of concrete. So for any beginning gardener, you can imagine that's a number of barriers that would, make you not want to move forward. But I discovered some ways to grow food in this not ideal experience. I put some raised beds on the driveway, and that was actually, it was an unused portion of the driveway, and that was actually easier than trying to dig into the ground to grow. And I discovered that leafy greens worked really well in these partial shady areas of the ground, and I didn't need to dig. I could just plant some seeds, and they could, those roots could work around those chunks of concrete pretty easily. And so as far as the quantity that I was growing, I would say I was probably harvesting with hundreds of pounds a year, maybe 300 pounds of vegetables a year. Which if this was a 10th of an acre that was flat and sunny, that's probably not very much, but it seemed like a lot for us, and it fed our household well.
Okay. Sarah, one of the terms you used when you were talking before, and Amy has also used, is edible landscape. Mm-hmm. What's that mean? What's an edible landscape?
Well, we all have to eat to survive, so it's just understanding what is in our landscape that we're able to consume. So even dandelions, even wild violets, we can eat those as long as they haven't been used with any type of pesticide. side claim there. But yeah, so just integrating some edibles. You know, personally, I like to integrate with our herbaceous non-edible plants. So I am definitely not an expert on that whatsoever. I enjoy talking with folks to see what is edible. I also would give that what I may eat or what I may brush up against, you know, I may not have a reaction to, but someone else may have a reaction to because their skin is more sensitive than the others. You know, dogwood, for example, they have little hairs on them that really irritate my skin. You know, those aren't edible, though the fruit is. So, you know, I prefer not to get around them very much. So, you know, just understanding the landscape in that way, soil is a huge factor in that. So really understanding that.
We'll get to that to a minute. But Peter, what would be examples of something that is edible in this edible landscape that you would encourage people to maybe get started with?
Well, there's the notion of eating weeds, you know. So you have lamb's quarter and purslane is a very good one. But to think about landscaping, when I think about edible landscaping, sometimes I think of it more instead of having boxwoods, what can you plant that would also produce food? I mean, there's bush cherries, and they grow a tart like pie cherry. It's a little bit smaller than the tree type varieties, but they're prolific and easy to maintain. Gooseberries and currants are another example. But also for your, Sarah mentioned putting a tomato or something in your front yard, or you can use, integrate annual vegetables also as part of your seasonal landscaping. And I think like, for instance, if you like hot peppers, Thai hot peppers are a good example. They turn red when they're mature and the peppers actually point up. So it's almost like a floral kind of situation. And so those are things that you can do.
And I want to go right away because we have a call that has come in and I want to make sure that we get to that. Sarah, you have a question?
I actually had a comment. You know, this conversation is really resonating with me. I have a really small yard here in Mount Healthy. And I was, when I was starting out, I couldn't figure out what went where and was getting really frustrated because I was buying all of these plants that were dying. And so as I continued to learn and grow more, I got involved with the Mount Healthy Renaissance Project and we started to have a plant swap. So this is an opportunity to bring plant divisions or seeds that are going, too well. And in exchange, grab something that maybe you don't have. And so that's this Saturday in Mount Healthy. And I just wanted to share that because as you're motivating new gardeners, they can come and try something out for free instead of having to go and purchase somewhere.
Are those common? Plant swaps? Seed swaps?
Yeah, there's seed swaps and plant swaps. But a lot of it, you know, there's a lot of stuff that's over the side fence of a house, you know, in a neighborhood, a lot of people. But a lot of people in community gardens, for instance, will, you know, share things because you start 20 tomato plants, you only need six. And, you know, there are 20 seeds in the pack, so that's what you plant. And then you pass those on to your others. But, yeah, perennials, like there's gardens all over town that have a variety of mint, chocolate mint that we have had at our community garden in Clifton years and years ago, and it's probably in 50 or more gardens throughout Cincinnati. Same thing, we have I've divided a lot of coneflower over the years, and they're in different places in different French yards.
Yeah, I think plant swaps are really exciting, and they are important pieces of creating community. When I was living in Delhi Township, I was managing the community garden at Mount St. Joe University. And, you know, I started the program because I wanted to meet other backyard gardeners, or in my case, you know, front yard gardeners. And but when you look down the street, if everybody's garden is in the backyard, you don't know that they're gardening. And so you have no way to connect. But when I started the community garden, we started having a plant sale with a seed swap every spring. And suddenly we started meeting so many more of our neighbors who were gardeners. And that was such a a great factor for bringing, you know, community and meeting like-minded folks in your area.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I love sharing plants, disease-free plants, if at all possible, with my family and friends and volunteers and around the community because it tells a story. So, you know, I still have plants from my grandmother, from her yard, and so forth and so forth. So to me, it's an engagement, community engagement, celebration. And it just brings life to the garden and more personal.
You know, one of the things that I think can be really helpful on your website, the 10th Acre Farm, it's easy to find. There's a virtual tour where you have a series of photographs. There's sort of the straightforward photograph first, and then the thing is, well, what do you see here? And then you have sort of pointing out what you have planted. And let's talk about the front yard, because that's what people see. You were just saying if everybody's got their garden in the back, you may not know what's going on. And in that front yard that you have, some of the plants that you have are exactly what Peter was talking about before, black and red currants that look like bushes up near the house. But how do you – one of the things that struck me looking at these photographs is that you're intermingling edibles with plants that are flowering plants that might just be seen as flowering garden plants. And this is not like you've plowed your front yard and you've put down rows of corn here. So talk a little bit about your theory, especially for the front yard, and because that's what you present to the public.
Yeah, that's right. I have an interest in aesthetically pleasing gardens. That's really important to me. I want to be on good terms with my neighbors. And so for me, it was important to for extending my gardening into the front yard, I wanted to make sure that it was pretty as well. And so that's the first thing. And, you know, our regular landscapes typically include many perennials. We usually have perennial bushes and shrubs. We typically have, you know, a specimen tree of interest, you know, that's a perennial. It's providing shade or aesthetic interest of some kind. But as Peter was saying earlier, we can swap those out for some edible alternatives, and they're going to provide that same beautiful interest, but then you're also getting a yield or giving something back.
So, for example, what could you swap out for a shade tree that you're seeing there?
Yeah. Well, you know, the first thing I wanted to mention is that, you know, Peter mentioned currants, gooseberries, and bush cherries. And I totally recommend those for shrubs, mainly because they can be pruned. So if you want, you know, a hedgerow of trees or shrubs in front of your front porch, but you want to keep them nice and tidy, those can actually be pruned with shears and look very nice and tidy. I love that. And so I had currants in the front yard. But as far as your question for a shade tree, I had cherry trees growing in my front yard. And they were absolutely gorgeous. The flowers are beautiful. And the three trees that I had were producing almost 30 pounds of cherries a year. So, you know, in a space that wasn't giving much before, now we're getting 30 pounds of fruit.
So, okay, a fruit tree. Mm-hmm. And I noticed in your backyard, you have figs. You have some plum. Mm-hmm. You have a variety of things going on back there too, right?
Yes.
So with the front yard, did you check with your neighbors before you started down this path? Or the other side of that, and or, what kind of reaction have you gotten from the neighbors who are paying for the monthly treatment of their yard from the lawn service and getting it cut to make sure the grass is exactly the right height? So what's been the reaction and how do you manage that?
Well, I could tell a number of stories. We'd be here all day.
That's just one or two.
But yeah, you know, the neighbors were quite interested when we initially dug up the front yard. It was late winter, so of course, you know, everything has died back for the year, and it's looking pretty sad to begin with. But then we started digging everything up to replant it with a new design, and We had all kinds of neighbors coming over and saying, you know, what's going on? What are you doing here? And we kind of explained what we were up to. But they were a little wary. But come midsummer, everything was leafed out and flowering and beautiful. And now they had a vision for what's possible. And they saw that it was just as beautiful as a regular landscape. And that really eased their worries a little bit. But, you know, as far as, you know, the chemicals you mentioned, you know, what happens if your neighbor is treating their lawn? We actually did have a neighbor whose yard drained into ours, and he liked to treat his lawn. And so we made it a conversation. You know, hey, we're trying to grow food without chemicals, and I see that your lawn runs into ours, and maybe I wonder if you might be interested in switching to the organic lawn care. We'd pay the difference. I think it's important to not state it as an accusation. I think it's important to make it a conversation and also to show that you're wanting to meet them in the middle. And he responded right away with, I've always gotten the lawn treatment, but I have no idea why. I'm just going to go ahead and cancel it. So we were able to grow our front yard garden chemical-free and without any sort of conflict with the neighbor.
And what I want to say is, you know, it's funny what I'm doing now. My father had his own lawn care service, and that's what put food on the table, and that's what he continues to do part-time. And so it's always one of those things, like, you know, we have to be mindful of it, be organic or non-organic, a chemical that we use, it be in our lawn or on our vegetables or on our fruit trees. You know, you have to follow those labels accordingly. And there may be some residuals in the mulch that we use or the soil or the compost that we get. So, you know, I know that all of us around the table today understand that we're not like saying never mow your lawn again, get rid of all your grass, but maybe integrating space and understanding, because grass is beneficial for the whole ecosystem of our landscape. You know, the clover could be, or an area for the children to play in. So there are purposes for turf grass. But maybe, you know, when it gets really thin or, you know, it's too shady for the fescue to grow, you know, maybe think about ways to do that. And maybe fertilizer isn't the way to make it grow all the time. Maybe understanding the ecosystem and why it's not. So I just want to be mindful of that. You know, we're not saying get rid of all your grass, you know, or anything like that. But maybe just dabbling in a little bit of putting some color into the landscape. And also I want to mention, too, with the pretty, you know, some folks may think that vegetable gardening is a little messy. And as Amy discussed, you know, and even Peter, we've been talking about flowers. So our vegetables need pollinators. So making sure that you understand that it's a relationship between all beneficial insects and the fruit that we have, because most of our crops need either a fly, like the pawpaw tree needs a fly to pollinate, or bumblebees or other flies, or the wind to pollinate, like corn. So just be very mindful of that whole unit. So, you know, talking to your neighbors and so that they can understand it all.
We have a caller who has called in, and I... Rebecca, I think you have a comment more than a question. I'm not sure, but go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for putting me on. I live in Mount Lookout, and I am absolutely a huge fan of Amy's because I have a big old suburban micro farm in my – I shouldn't say big, but in my front yard.
Yeah, big and micro don't go together.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, it started out with, you know, a few basil plants when we moved into this house 20 years ago. Now – we've torn up the front lawn. It's got three raised beds in it, and then I put gravel all around so that my husband didn't have to try to mow around the beds. Almost more than 50% by far of what's out here is edibles, and I'm not sure that all my neighbors love it, but other than the landscaper who used to live down the street, no one has ever said anything negative, and lots of people walking by love it. We're eating a ton of healthy organic food out of our front yard, and it's definitely a lifestyle. the choice that we've made, and having Amy right here in Cincinnati. When I discovered she was in Cincinnati, I got really excited. I asked for her book for Mother's Day, the best gardening book, mm-hmm. most specific to what I'm doing. So it's been the best gardening book I've ever had. Just a big fan.
Very good. Very good. Thank you for calling, Amy. You want to say anything to that? Or?
Wow. I'm speechless, but thank you for that compliment. It's nice to hear from mothers who have read the book and who are doing really great things in their yard. It's your passion is coming through for sure.
Peter, we have a email that has come in, and someone has asked, now this is the sort of counterpoint here a little bit, but Narson, I think is their name, wants to know a good grass to grow in this area that for a yard, I guess, or maybe major sections of a yard that only gets about 5 hours of sun during the day.
Well, that's actually a Dave Kester question. I'm a vegetable grower, not a grass.
I'm not a grass grower.
I'm no good with turf, but I do want to do. Do you have any suggestions on that, Sarah?
So most of our cool season grasses actually like the fescue. They like cooler weather. So once we get into these hot temperatures and high humidity, they start to brown out. So any of the fescue blends, we actually have recommendation varieties. If you want to call me or look on our website, I would be happy to share that with you. But you will always get a blend, usually 3 to 4 different types of varieties within that blend. And so fescues do well. You may get a rye within that blend. The rye will quickly germinate. And then it may brown out a little bit. But I would go with a fescue blend. It tolerates cooler. But if it gets less than 5 hours, then I would think about maybe turning that into a more shade, a shade ornamental or edible landscape.
Or is it a ground cover question?
It could be. I mean, there are ornamental grasses, if that's what this person is wanting to do. There are low-growing grasses, ornamental grasses that you don't have to mow, or ground covers, both edible and ornamental, that you can do as well. So, you know, maybe we can have a conversation or that caller can send some pictures, photos. I would be happy to look over that part of that landscape and have further discussion.
So I'm going to go straight to Matt, who has been waiting for a little while. And Matt, you have a question that's pretty broad, pretty big. So go ahead and let's pose that.
Yeah, thanks for letting me comment. And you've done my work for me. Just wanting to find out from your guests if they could elaborate a little bit on what permaculture is. I really just wanted to bring it into the conversation. I hear there's a lot of talk about gardening and intelligent sort of landscaping and design. And I think the word permaculture is such a needed concept to get out there and to get people interested. And there's great resources out there. Gaia's Garden, Toby Hemingway's book, and so much other information out there about it. And Cincinnati has its own kind of permaculture movement, I think, that's pretty readily accessible.
A whole movement. Amy, what is permaculture?
Well, you ask the question that almost everybody starts out by asking, what is permaculture? It's one of those words that doesn't immediately give you a definition by hearing it. So when I think of permaculture, I think of it as a design science that allows us to create food-producing areas or growing sites that work with nature. So this is an ecologically friendly, ecologically integrated way of producing food. So we're not doing it at the expense of the environment or the local ecology. We are hoping to enhance the local ecology at the same time as producing food for ourselves. And I love that Matt, the caller, brought this up because I got my start with permaculture about 10 years ago here in Cincinnati. And I'm so thankful to the Cincinnati Permaculture Institute that actually brings permaculture courses and classes and activities and even a perennial nursery to the local community. So Yeah, I wanted to mention that.
Well, I want to point out that on your website, the 10th Acre Farm, the cut line is permaculture in the suburbs. And you even have a, I don't know if it's a blog or a little article there about, you know, how to choose the right permaculture class and make sure that you get in the right one. So, Peter, what about permaculture and its the institute, its growing popularity, and people's interest in this?
Well, so like the term whole system design, which Amy alluded to, I think is really the key part of it, because it not only looks at, you know, growing plants, but it looks like managing stormwater. It looks at, you know, what they call dividing your home or your farm or whatever into zones, you know, in terms of, you know, the things that you need to do more frequently, you put closer to the main hub, your house, and then step it out from that. Also, I thought it was interesting when I visited Amy's 10th acre farm in Delhi, her husband, Vince. It was very interesting the way they set it up. It's because I looked around the base of plants and they were mulch, but then you look closer and you realize it was just material that was cut back and then chopped up and orderly placed underneath the plant. So everything that was on site was reused. And I think that we look at that in farming and gardening a lot through the use of compost, but there are creative uses also for mulching. And particularly if you have ornamental grasses, when you cut them back, you can simply ring the ornamental grass with the cuttings of the plants. And depending on how artistic you are, you can make it actually look quite presentable to anybody. So I think it's a mindset of, you know, once I took a workshop with this guy, Mark Shepherd, and he said the word problem is just the word profit misspelled. It's like looking at things differently.
So you were, Sarah, raising some questions about mulch before, and I think we were off air at the time, but what was your question at that point?
You know, we always come across like how to be more environmentally, you know, friendly with our watering practices, you know, and never fails how much planning we do. I don't know if it's just me or what, but it's like all these raised beds and community gardens that we're dealing with and working with, we seem not to have the mulch, you know, or something always comes up. So now I'm working on a project and we're trying to figure out what is the best mulch that is, you know, more financially, you know, I guess, friendly. So, you know, in my world, I would use like a pine straw, but it could be a little costly. And sometimes if you can even find it, you know, Peter mentioned pine fines, which I forgot. And I didn't have time to mulch up my leaves and, you know, get that already. This is kind of a quick, you know, fix, if you will. So, you know, we just, that's all, you know, in talking about ornamental grasses. So if you have the time and space in order to kind of harvest and keep this material there, then you can mulch with that.
But Amy, how do you think about mulch?
You know, I have been thinking about mulch very creatively. When Sarah first presented the question, I immediately thought, as Peter did, you know, shredded leaves, just everything you can collect that falls naturally on your property, you know, collecting that in the fall, shredding it up, and then, you know, keeping it in a bin that you can use when your gardens get started in the spring. I've never used pine mulch, but that's pretty interesting. One thing that did really great for me, and I think you just mentioned it's not going to work at a last minute, but is growing the ornamental grasses, mm-hmm. because they are super productive and you can cut them back and they actually act like a straw or a hay. So that's one that I really like. But when I was on my little 10th of an acre, I focused on growing plants that were really prolific. Mm-hmm. So this might be something that you grow on the perimeter of a community garden or a raised bed garden, something that you can chop back regularly throughout the season and just lay it down as mulch in between your plants and your raised beds. One that I like is comfrey, but that's not the only one to use. That's just one that I happen to grow a lot of on my property. Mm-hmm.
So just to make sure that we close the loop here on permaculture, because it sounds like a pretty fancy, maybe abstract term, if it's done right, Is it actually simpler than maintaining that lawn with the grass and keeping the turf going the way people like it to look and all of that sort of thing? Is it as difficult as it may sound or obtuse as it may sound or whatever? Is permaculture just, you know, if you do it right, you learn, sort of experiment with it, it works?
Yeah, I remember seeing some photos before at a museum, actually, the Egyptians were practicing permaculture. And I'm sure even before that, folks were farmers, were practicing permaculture. So in fact, this one particular drawing was their irrigation practices, funneling water all the way down through the city and then going into their farmland. So that is permaculture, understanding the flow of water and then allowing that to and collecting that and then letting that irrigate your area. So that is one part of permaculture. And then also then placing your garden so that in accordance of the sun. So working with all of that. But it's been going on forever.
So concepts that are basic to farming, like contour farming and mm-hmm. taking into account that, and you were saying that your front yard wasn't flat. It had a contour to it. Is that part of the permaculture planning process?
Yeah, that's right. You know, the big word in permaculture is design. So what we're doing is before we even plant, we are observing the land to see what it can offer us. We're watching those sun patterns. Ideally, in permaculture, we say that the ideal situation is that you can observe your property for about a year so that you can really get to know those sun patterns on the land as you know, they change with the seasons. You can watch the rain patterns throughout the season and watch when does your soil dry up in the summer? At what point does that happen? And at what points during the season is the ground so saturated that you might not want to work it? And, you know, which areas seem richer? Which areas do the soils seem richer and which not? And so, and then even getting an idea of where the slope is, where does water run to? And so water is a big part of permaculture. And that was the key aspect of designing my front yard garden. So we collected rainwater from the roof and we directed it through a permaculture technique called a swale, which is a ditch dug on contour, and it collects that water. And then there's a berm on the downhill side that you plant. And I planted mine with deep-rooted strawberries, which are very aesthetically pleasing in the front yard. And that water overflowed into a rain garden that had a lot of ornamentals, but also some edibles planted there. And this whole system was very low maintenance, as you alluded to. If it's designed right and it's passively irrigated, it can really create a system where not a whole lot of watering needs to be done, and the plants are happier. And in fact, below our front yard gardens, towards the street, we still had some lawn, existing lawn, and our lawn tended to be greener longer into the season than many of our neighbors, even though they were irrigating with sprinklers and such, because our way of passively irrigating through the ground was just so much healthier and the grass was greener. So whether you're, you know, water irrigating a lawn or whether you're irrigating a garden, there are low maintenance ways to do it.
Do you use sprinklers at all?
I haven't yet. So I'm not totally against sprinklers, but I think it can be an inefficient way to garden, because especially if you're using it on a hot summer's day, a lot of that's going to evaporate off.
So, Peter, this control of maintenance of water is probably pretty key for every gardener.
Oh yes, I mean, we're turning it with our with the community garden program for Turner Farm. Our farm are more like market garden style instead of the wooden boxes, but we're using drip irrigation systems. Just because it's just so much more efficient. But, you know, the idea of permaculture being kind of a workless system, I mean, that's kind of a misconception, because mm-hmm. it's really an active partnership with nature. And I think that's the beautiful part of it. You know, it's not like people think, oh, I just do this and I come back 9 months later and harvest all this stuff. But there are small little gestures that are done during the course of the growing season. And also making, like Amy said, I think it's really important to, you know, observe your land, figure out what sun patterns are, but also when you select food-bearing plants and shrubs. For instance, the European cultivars of fruit trees are very problematic in terms of diseases. Pear is probably, and cherry, tart pie cherry, not sweet cherry, are probably the least prone to disease and easiest to grow. But the currants and gooseberries and blackberries, they're much easier to maintain. And so think about what the, you know, long-term effects are. Also, a big apple tree, you know, can create a lot of litter, what your neighbors aren't going to like. Whereas a cherry tree, what you don't pick, the birds usually get.
Well, the trick, we had cherry trees in our yard as I was growing up. The trick was to get the cherries before the birds got them. It was a timing situation. Yeah. In fact, speaking of animals, you're planting this wonderful urban garden. What do you do about deer? What do you do about other animals? Especially deer, as I think we all know, they're everywhere because they've been displaced from forest and whatever, and they're everywhere in the urban environment. So do you do anything actively to manage that?
Well, I think Sarah and Peter are probably going to have some good suggestions about this. I recently moved from my 10th-acre farm to a 3-acre property that's mostly wooded. And when I was living, you know, on my 10th of an acre, we saw a deer every once in a while, but it really wasn't an issue. And I didn't have to be concerned with that when I planted and selected my plants. But now that is absolutely a concern for me. And I'm starting to go through the process of selecting plants and figuring things out, how to work with the deer. And I think that's the key. I think we want to figure out how we can work with them. Mm-hmm. We know that they're there. So, you know, rather than seeing them as an enemy, I kind of like seeing them as a challenge. You know, how can I work my, you know, garden into living alongside them? Because I don't want them to go away. I like having them in my woods. One of the things that we can do is, this is very simple, is learn their patterns, because deer have a pattern that they walk. I notice on my property, the route that they take is always the same route as they walk through. And if I'm going to plant things on that route, I can expect them to be eaten. It's like planting them a buffet. But there is other portions of my yard that they don't go to as often. And I notice that I can put things over there without any sort of coverage or protection at all, and they don't bother them. So I think the first key is learning their habits and their routine.
Sarah, any suggestions about deer and or other? If you have a garden, everybody knows rabbits are, you know, going to be very interested in what you're planting.
Yeah, I think that's always going to be a challenge. And so, yeah, understanding their patterns for sure. I was once told, which I personally am doing this on my property, is planting them a garden. So understanding their where they move in my landscape, and then I'm just going to just put them where I have my compost pile. They can have anything that I plant around there. And then
so what do they like?
Oh, hostas, lettuce, you know, anything, you know, my watermelon, you know. So I kind of focus that there. And then all of my produce that I want so far this year, and I'm dabbling in with lettuce. So I haven't, you know, that's kind of like their gold to go to. And so I don't know if you guys have any experience with that, but we do try fencing. We have other deterrents that we're using, but I'm trying to go away from as much of that. And if I can't grow that, then honestly, I just go to the farmer's market.
Peter?
Well, the decoy crops, like Sarah says, good. I mean, we do a lot of berries and small fruit at home. And so we have mulberry trees, which have a long mm-hmm. berry season, and the birds actually seem to prefer those over the other things.
Yes.
Now, we do have to tent the blueberries you know, that's like a premium crop for them. But for lettuces and things too, you can use, like we talk about for season extension, using low tunnels, but you can use like a low tunnel system with shade cloth over it and or bird netting, and that'll keep the animals away from that. They don't like things that are wiggly. Mm-hmm. And then we also use, fencing, you know, different, you know, high fencing. But then also we've been experimenting with this fencing system called 3D fencing, where it's a fence that's two layers. There's one, a shorter section in the front, a taller one in the back, and it messes with their depth perception. Mm-hmm. The best use of it is to be electrified, but you can't do that in a neighborhood. But we've people I know have been experimenting with just setting them up non-electric, and that has been effective.
Okay. Sarah, you just said that you moved from your 10th-acre farm to a 3-acre farm, an explosion of land. So does it change? Does it force a real change in the way you think about all of this?
You know, it's actually well, it's exciting for me. I think one of the reasons why I liked this property is because it's mostly wooded, so that my space, my potential space for growing is actually still quite small in comparison. It's probably very comparable to the 10th acre. So a lot, the only thing that's really changing about my strategies at this point are learning to deal with the deer. That's one of the big things that I'm still in the process of learning.
And you have to keep in conversation with Peter on that.
Yes.
Who,
seems
to have a real relationship. So I want to thank Amy Strauss, Peter Huttinger, and Sarah Stoles for being with us today. And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. Selena Reeder is our assistant producer. Layla Shukui is our intern. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Archives of our program are available at wvxu.org. I'm Dan Hurley. Stay tuned for on 91.7 WVXU for Here and Now, coming up next.